Hey, welcome to the OK Show. I'm your host, Andrea Swenson, and this is the show where real musicians talk about their real lives. It's brought to you by The Current, and today is the season one finale. I could not be more excited and honored to share this conversation with you. My guest on the show this week is Claire Monasterio, who performs under the name Manchita with the hip-hop group Girl Party. We'll dive into our interview in just a few minutes, but first a little bit about Claire and why I wanted to invite her onto the show. So I first met Claire as a fellow audience member at a show, and I quickly recognized her as an incredibly sweet, genuine, and relatable person. She's the kind of person that you always hope to run into when you're out. She's always ready with a hug and a smile, and it was such a thrill to learn over the years that she was secretly working on her own music as well. Watching Claire perform with groups like The Club and Girl Party has been a revelation. She transforms into a completely different person when she gets up on stage with aggressive delivery and incredible dance moves. It's kind of hard to take your eyes off of her. She's a hell of a rapper, too, often spitting in double time and throwing out these little double entendres and clever turns of phrase that'll make your head spin. She's fierce. Claire Manchita, she's also a very complex person, and she's endured a lot in her 3 decades on this planet. She's dealt with severe, serious mental health issues over the years and has spent a lot of time doing what she describes as investigating her tics and trying to get to the bottom of her trauma and her struggles. She's also endured some devastating losses. In 2010, the man she had been in an on-and-off-again relationship with for 5 years passed away from an overdose. And in 2013, the house she was living in caught on fire, and she and her roommates lost many of their possessions and their pet cat in the flames. Through it all, Claire has persevered, continuing to write prolifically about her life and sharing those experiences in breathtaking clarity on several of Girl Party's tracks. She somehow manages to balance those banging party beats in the group's music with these incredibly poignant, personal, occasionally devastating lyrics. And she makes it work. If you've ever heard the group sing Ash Everywhere, Ash, Ash Everywhere, a song about the house fire, you'll know what I mean. My conversation with Claire went all over the place. We talked about anxiety, we talked about feminism, and we focused in on the source of so much of her pain over the past 5 years, which is a story about her relationship to a major figure in the hip-hop world that she's never shared publicly before today. You're going to want to listen to this one the whole way through. I promise you, you won't regret it.
Hey, Claire.
Hey, Andrea.
Hey, Manchita. What other names hey. Do you go by?
Oh, Cheetah.
Cheetah.
Cheetah, that's yeah. like my nickname.
Yeah. When did you start going by Manchita? I don't know that story.
It was first La Manchita, but I dropped the La, which still follows me around in yeah. many articles. But that word in Spanish just means tiny stain, like a little stain, oh. or blemish, or scar, or like mark, or imperfection, or just like to be manchada is to be like spotty or dirty or like if you Google image Manchita, like puppies with spots on their eyes will show up.
Oh no,
because everybody names their dog Manchita because like spot.
Okay. Oh, I like a spot around their eye, not like
yeah.
on their eye.
Right,
I
not on their eye.
Like
sorry,
a grotesque.
No, like Petey, like Petey from the Little Rascals.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. It also means like little female person, little girl or woman from La Mancha, which is in Spain, which is where my family is from. But yeah, Cheetah for short, which Lizzo gave me
yeah.
as a nickname.
Yeah.
You know. Like, you rap too fast, Cheetah. I was like, okay, I'll take it. That works.
You've been around the scene for a long time, but mm-hmm. not necessarily always as a hip-hop artist.
Right.
And we were just talking before we turned the microphone on, and I want to hear this story about when is the first time that you rapped?
The first time that I rapped was at Nick and Eddie on February 24th.
I love that you know the date. Do you know what time it was?
It was, it might have been after midnight, so it might have technically been the 25th.
Of what year?
I believe that was 2010.
Okay.
So that was with Dave Matters and Olson, Ryan Olson, and Death Squads, basically. And Ryan and I had, like, started this song or whatever, and he was like, you just got to come up and rap it. We're just going to, like, throw the beat into this crazy Death Squads mix, and you're just going to come up and rap. I was like, okay, I'll do it, sure. And so I did it, and that was that.
Had you dabbled in rapping, like, alone? Or
no. So August 6th of that same year, Ryan had, basically, he called me over before the February situation and was like, I got this beat, you should, like, do something with it. Because he was just, like, willy-nilly trying to find, like, a project and just, like, throwing things around. And I was like, okay, I don't know what I'll do with it. But I ended up rapping on it, which felt weird because I was always told myself I would never be a rapper. I, like,
really?
Resisted it really hard.
That's specifically something you had in mind. I will never be a rapper.
I will never be a rapper.
Interesting.
Yeah. For various reasons, I think, but he had invited me over. I made the thing, did the doo-doo, did the little show with him or whatever, and I was like, okay, that was fun. That was, like, fine. That's over with. But then August 6th, so 6 months later, he calls me, and I was nannying, and he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm just wrapping up. I'm about to go home from this kid's house. And he was like, okay, I'm going to need you to rap on something. And I was like, Ryan, that was, like, a one-time thing. Like, I don't rap. And he was like, no, you got it. And I was like, nah, I really don't even know what you're talking about. Because he had Jason Power, he had Sobbing Purses there, and they were looking for a female rapper. And I was like, nah, it's really not my thing. He was like, listen, be here no later than 6 o'clock, and hung up the phone. It was like there was no question in my head. I was like, well, I can't be late.
Yeah.
You know, so I showed up and got the beat and rapped. And they were like, okay. And we recorded it and stuff, and that was that. And he was immediately like, okay, you need to work with Jeremy Nutzman, Spider Baby. He was like, you need to work with Mike. You need to work with Muck. You need to, like, he started, you know, facilitating as he does so well. And then it just kind of went from there.
So what did you rap about?
The first one was, I remember it was called The Rally. And I was like, I was basically commenting on what it feels like to go to a club or, like, a bar, and how people, like, pair off at the end of the night, and how it's, like, a rally for the singles trying to get it, you know? Like,
yeah.
How people feel like they have to, like, leave with someone at the end of the night, and, like, what did I say? This is a rally for the singles trying to marry up or something like that, but about, like, the meat market, this, like, sensation, like, when you're out and you're single and you, like, you know someone's, like, shopping for you and they're, like, scoping, and you, like, watch people, like, pair off and you're like, ee, that weird feeling of just, like, this feels so animal. Not
right.
That being an animal is bad, but, like, there was something really off-putting about it for me, and so it was just a commentary on, like, this culture of drinking and fucking, essentially. Can I say that?
Yeah. I'll edit you.
Having sex.
Beep.
Drinking and sexing. And then the other song that we did together was Jeremy's song, but then I wrote these verses for it, and he ended up giving it to me because he was like, nah, you do it, and I'll just do the hook with you. And I was like, okay. And that one is about, that one has since changed into a new song that I will be releasing as soon as it is mixed and mastered. And I cannot wait. But it's about street harassment. So just like, it's pretty silly, but it's kind of like a huge middle finger to just like, I really don't really want your commentary on my body. I don't need it.
Yeah.
I can totally survive without it. It's like
not
a vitamin.
Yeah.
It's actually like poison. So
I can't believe, I mean, that's been a topic in the like national dialogue in this last year. And I could not believe how many guys in my life were not aware that that happens.
Right.
It was crazy. Like, people that I consider, like, fairly progressive thinkers.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, has that happened to you? And I was like, yeah. And then I name, like, four different times in, like, the last 2 months. And they're like, well, and they, you could see the wheels turning in their mind, like, trying to explain it away. Like, well, no, I got nothing.
Yeah, it's like, basically, are you trying to say you've done that to someone? It's like, that's how you're justifying it somehow, you know? I've caught myself, like, yelling out the window at a beautiful woman before and being like, oh, my God, what happened? happened? I've been overcome. You know what I mean? I'm sorry. It's like the next thing I yell. But like, I get how it happens, I think, because you're just like, holy God, what a beautiful person.
Right.
I'm stricken.
It's an animal instinct.
It is, but so is murder.
Right.
You know? So it's like, nah, definitely smarter than that. You know? Don't have to do that. I remember when I was like 18, 19, and I had to take the, I worked at a restaurant in the Mall of America, and I had like a 2-hour like metro transit situation every time I needed to get to and from work. There was a bus stop on Lake right in front of Kmart.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting there for the bus. This, it was many, 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 many times. It happened so many times. I remember one time a guy like pulled up into the parking lot behind me and like got halfway out of his driver's side, and he was like, get in the car. And I was like, excuse me? He's like, get in the car right now. And I was like, whoop, grabbed all my stuff and just ran down the street. Like, I didn't know what to do, but that was like the most abrasive one where I was, the guy was like trying to abduct me or whatever.
Right.
But there were all, so many incidences on that specific corner that I started wearing like the dirtiest. I would wear dirty sweatpants over my clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tuck my hair up into a hat, and I bought fake glasses at Ragstock. And I had like, I always had a hat on, and I always had like as much covering as I possibly could, even in like the heat of the summer. Just yeah. Like, which is so dumb.
Nothing real, authentic, true was ever sold, but I got no proof. Gotta take my word as bond. Bet the loot and set the gray goose loose. Shot and vibe, and not even kinda thinking it through. Hands together, better pray, but play on who? We flew the coop, and now it's one big get full of plump chickens. Let the beheading begin. We hash it out like civil women.
Totally pro.
Yup. One for the true, two for the ball, and three for the crew. Sing it.
Can I just say how awesome it was when you threw bloody tampons at everyone at First Avenue?
Yeah, I have to do it.
It was.
I have to do that.
I just, so I guess in my mind, as I'm experiencing that moment, like, that show is just so powerful on so many levels, because you guys,
thank you,
just the energy that you bring as a group is unstoppable. But then to have you rapping about your period and then to see you throwing these bloody tampons out, in my mind it was like, you know what, there's been so much talk about like, are you or are you not a feminist in recent years, and this is what it actually looks like to put like womanhood in people's faces and be like, deal with this, like this is what we deal with all the time, and this is our reality and our experience. And I don't even have a question. I just wanted to tell you that I thought that was so amazing.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was something I felt. That period song was the easiest song I've ever written, because I have verses that didn't even make the cut, because I feel like I've been writing it my whole life. Just like, you know, like, and it just was one of those things where, in terms of rap music and hip hop specifically, one of the things that's always like the push and pull for me is that I felt for so long that there wasn't a place for me there as a woman, because I can rap along to you, sir. But as soon as you're like, you know, saying, what is it? I fucked your Hampton spouse, her Hampton mouth, her Hampton blouse, like, then you lost me. I don't feel like this is for me. I feel like it's against me, and I feel reduced and I feel objectified. Even though you're not talking about me, I've never been to the Hamptons. I don't own a blouse, you know?
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that just automatically draws a line. And it's so ingrained into the music and the ideology. And there's just like a lot of sexism built into the culture, essentially. And that was something that I always struggled with. And I was really present for the hip-hop scene in the Twin Cities, like, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to, like, leave, because I just felt so reduced all the time.
Mm.
I had to step out, because it was, like, the role of women was, you're either someone's, like, bitch for the night, or you're somebody's girlfriend, and either way, you don't really get respect.
Yeah.
You know? And it's, like, if you're just hanging around, or if you're around, then you, like, literally have had people be like, oh, you're mine tonight. Excuse me?
Whoa.
I beg your pardon? Like, do I have a choice in this at all? Did you just assume that I'm here to take my pants off? That's cool. all right.
Yeah.
It just got exhausting, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like people like Dessa have really, because of her, like, content and her presentation and just, like, her general, like,
manera de ser,
like, her way to of being, or, like, her, like, her, just the way she carries herself and presents herself.
She's her, like, ethos.
She's a strong, like, smart, confident woman. I really value what she's done, because I think that she's, I think she and I are, we go in completely different directions, and our, like, maneras de ser are very different, but I think that without her, I wouldn't, many of us wouldn't have a place, you know? And I think, you know, with her and the changing of the times, and, like, you know, you get younger people coming up, so you have younger men coming into the scene too, who see things differently. They're not like, they're not stuck in this older way. And so there is more room to grow and more room to breathe. Once that flexibility started to shine through and I was able to see that, I was like, oh, maybe I can participate, because maybe I don't have to be on the outside. I can make a place. And so I'm bringing this back to the tampon song, because I felt like that was, like, I never had a song that was for me in hip hop and rap. I didn't have, like, an anthem that was like, oh, I relate to everything about this. And so I made that song because I was like, this is just as bottom line as I can get. Oh, you have a tampon at your home because you need it sometimes? Because you're a female. Come here. Listen to this song. You will understand. Or maybe you'll think it's, like, way over the top. And that's fine, too. But it's really an invitation. Do you know what I mean?
It's absolutely.
Like, it's like a call and kind of like a step off. I'm going to go a little bit over the top here because it needs to be done. Like,
yeah.
We have to kind of reverse some stuff. And
yeah. I think that's why it resonated with me so strongly, because it felt kind of radical, but also very basic. Like,
yeah.
It hit me on this basic level of, like, as you were saying, you know, I, not only in the hip hop world, but just, like, as a, like, a woman trying to have a voice in the music community, like, yeah, it's hard to feel like anyone cares or that it matters at all what I have to say. I feel like in my situations, a lot of people are basically trying to get me to prove that I deserve to be here, that I know enough, that I'm smart enough. And for whatever reason, like, seeing that bloody tampon coming at me, I was like, yes.
Yes.
I think I even got choked up a little bit.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was special.
That means a lot to me. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I tried to make them... did, like, design them in a way that was not frightening.
Right.
Because I think, okay, as a person with anxiety, if you are dangerous on stage, you lose me immediately. I'm not with you anymore. I'm suddenly afraid. And I'm not paying attention. I'm not receiving anything that you're doing. And so my goal was not to, like, scare people. It was more to, like, I made them, I think they look beautiful, actually. They're like little red tip torpedoes, you know, because I just pushed the tip out a little bit and dipped it in the red Kool-Aid, and they're completely sanitary, you know. I always warn the venue before I do it, and I pick up after myself.
I'm just picturing you with a dustpan and a broom afterwards.
Yeah. I've signed some tampons.
Oh, cute.
In life, which is a pretty remarkable thing, I think.
Yeah.
I think I won't ever forget that. But people, like, pulling bloody tampons out of their purses, like, oh my God, I caught one. Will you please sign it? And it's like, my signature's worth nothing. Yes, I will sign that tampon. You need to take it back. Let's just keep it cash, baby, until you fall off. Keep it hella tart, honey. Cranberry sauce. Looking for a turkey to eat tonight. New school, new rules, right? No more salmonella, cause I'ma eat you raw, bloody. Give maple syrup, cause I'm sweet enough already. Bummer, sucker, got you looking like some supper. Talking about my mother. Night watch, better watch out. Sure, don't make me send my owls out. Ow, yow, bout with the outlaw. Black man's black session with the mean. Where does your anxiety come from? That's a good question. I don't know exactly where it comes from, but I know that it started when I was very little. Well, it probably comes from, you know, genetic predispositions. So I was set up a certain way. Those traits didn't necessarily need to be expressed, but based on information I was given, and the way that I was raised, I think those genes were expressed to their fullest potential because I spent a lot of time being very, very afraid. I think a lot of my anxiety started really, really early because I was told that I wouldn't have control over my body and that there were going to be constant threats. And so I believed there were constant threats. That's a great way to develop anxiety, you know?
You're on alert.
Yes, I was on alert. And I think when we really look at a lot of problems or like really tough emotions like jealousy or grief or anger, they all come down to fear if you really interrogate them enough.
Yeah.
And I think that's where my anxiety definitely started. And I'm still trying to like pull it apart and untie the knot. I've gotten really far. It's not as big of a knot as it used to be, which is amazing. Sometimes there are days that go by that I don't even think about the anxiety that I had in 2006. That was like the peak of it. And the fact that I didn't think about it yesterday is like astonishing to me, that I can be in a place where that's not like the forefront of what I'm thinking about, and that I'm not I can go outside without gloves on in the summer now. Mm-hmm. Like there are so many physical compulsions that I had about sensations and the way my skin felt and needing to spin around a certain number of times to reverse the energy that I felt like I was twisting in the universe and unwinding and evening out. And that's what I called it, was evening out.
Yeah.
So yeah, very early on, I think fear was the thing that really spawned my anxiety. Hmm. And anxiety led to OCD and eventually Tourette's. But it was pretty mild to moderate Tourette's. People hear Tourette's and they think that you just cuss out loud a lot and need to say a lot of profane things. My verbal tics were not the main tics that I had, but my verbal tics were usually no and don't or stop. And they were usually tics at myself, to yell at myself to stop ticking, you know? So it's just a cycle.
Right.
But fear, to answer your question, I think that's where it came from, was fear. I got a degree in child psychology, thank God. Because I learned so much about myself and I learned so much about the brain and how the brain develops and about these developmental pathologies that I don't like the word disorder.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I think it implies a sort of like permanence or like a sort of like external locus of control. Like you have no power over it. You can't control anything about it. It's a disorder and your brain is broken. Like
right.
You just said,
right.
I mean, over time, yes, you're building these crooked synapses in your brain and you are building a break. Like you are building yourself broken. The spark.
Yeah.
Everything started peaking when I was like 21, 22. And I could barely leave my house. I had gloves on all the time. I was like 110 pounds. I couldn't function. Everything was out of control. I couldn't be in public because I didn't have control over my tics in the way that I needed to feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I was so rough that it became obvious to me that I was going to continue living this way for a very short time and not be able to handle it and then be done.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was going to need to take steps to reinvent is not it. I needed to interrogate my brain and interrogate my tics and my triggers.
Yeah.
Because I had no choice.
Yeah.
You know? It was really, really hard because I was so good at hiding it from everybody. And it was like finally everybody in my family couldn't deny it anymore. Being able to get diagnosed, which I did as an adult, finally getting those diagnoses, it was like liberating in a way. I think sometimes people get a diagnosis and they're like, well, that's it. Now we know what's wrong with me. Now I just got to take my meds or do whatever I got to do to just, this is part of my identity now. Where I understood it to be like, okay, now I understand what happened.
Yeah.
I understand where I've ended up. And now I know there's cognitive behavioral therapy. I know there's trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. I've I've watched it work. I worked in a lab with trauma-focused CBT. Mm. I worked with children who were the kids who were on the bus on 35W, and helping them recover from that. Like, wow. I worked in settings where I was able to help recover children from traumatic events and redirect them from PTSD. And I realized that although I didn't have that intervention at the time, I could understand myself in the same way. So I know that, like, the way that my brain is wired, I am set up to develop, to continue having potentially obsessive compulsions, but I need to be aware as they develop what they are, so yeah. that I'm not setting myself up again, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think getting that degree in child psych is probably something that saved my life, honestly.
It makes sense.
Huge.
So what are you doing now with that degree?
I am a preschool teacher. Oh. I work at a Spanish immersion Montessori preschool with little Latino children, and they are so sweet and so cute, and I love them. But yeah, I am teaching kids, and I was a nanny for 10 years. I really like kids. I found that originally when I first started nannying in 2005, that a lot of my anxiety and depression wouldn't say dissipated, but I was able to almost, like, there was some maternal or like some instinct inside of me that was able to say, I can't impose this upon them.
Mm.
I can't make them spin in this circle with me. Yeah. You know, and so I'm going to let go of their hand for a second. I'm going to do it myself, or I'm going to do it in another room, because I don't want to transfer it, yeah. you know, and there's some other thing that kicks in where you just know to put the child first, and suddenly you're not having the same impulses anymore because there's something else happening. I don't know how to explain it. They're so important and so genuine and so pure. It's almost like you forget anything is wrong.
Yeah. I've had that feeling before.
Yeah. And because they don't judge you.
Yeah.
And if they see you tick, they're just like, oh, that was silly. You know, you're like, yeah, I had to bite my ear real quick. It's not a big deal. But yeah, there's like an innocence there, and there's hope, and there's just some sort of like light that you get to channel your own child inside of you that maybe didn't get to all the way fully express itself or be the kid it needed to be.
Yeah.
And I think I really love kids. I really do. I never want to be a mom, but I really love kids.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Track star, treat it like you don't know. I need out, you gotta let me go. You got me on my very last good knee now. You dare say no. You got the helm, I'm straight to hell. You rather die than ask for help. I'm trying to play all of the cards you dealt. All in, all well. Gamble the skin off of my face. The wind is gonna take it all away. Throw me to the wolves for a little taste. It's just a game. Say you saved me from the snake. Said you did it all for my sake. Cheers to the hunter when we play. And I'm still your prey.
So one thing I really wanted to talk to you about was the process of putting like more personal, not just tampon music, but you know, other experiences that you've had, especially, you know, very serious experiences like loss. Like, you have a song about your house fire, mm-hmm. and into style of music that Girl Party is so upbeat and so focused on. Yeah. I mean, party is in the name. Mm-hmm. How do you balance those two kind of goals? Like, you want to be like, you know, infusing this energy, but also like revealing something about yourself.
That's a good question. It's a hard balance. I think when Girl Party started, like, Lizzo and I were coming out of the club, and that was strictly party music. Just like, we literally, the hook was, we in the club, we don't give a f- like that was the hook of our first song of an EP that never got released. But I think Lizzo and I had come off of that wave and we were like, we're going to keep this going. And we're going to, I think the party in our name is kind of, ironic is not the word, but it's like tongue in cheek in a way. Mm. Because we will make you dance, but if you listen, we'll also, we're also like interrogating a lot of norms, you know, and we're, I think party is meant to be like, it's meant to imply a celebration instead of just like a willy-nilly, let's all get faded and take our shirts off or whatever, which is super fun, by the way. but I know that for me, it is really hard to just write lighthearted stuff. I have a really hard time. The first things that come out of me are always just like this deep, dark, perpetual grief. And making that palatable is the trick, you know? So I poke fun at myself and my heaviness, I think. And that's how I find my balance. And then there, it was like the Ashes song, the Go song, the one you're talking about, the fire.
Yeah.
That one was a kind of, it just had to happen. Girl Party came out of that fire. That fire happened, and that was like, we wrote Wegala like a month later, and then we just kept writing and kept writing and kept writing, and then by the summertime it was like, we're probably like, I was, Lauren and Lizzo, or Sophia Aris and Lizzo, had like a separate project that they had been working on with just the two of them, and I was featured on every song, and I was like, why don't we, dudes, like, what are we doing? And they were like, for real, let's just make this a thing. And I was like, okay. So I think that fire was like the fertile ground that we, that I needed to have this kind of energy to move forward. And I think out of that, a lot of what we are doing now came into fruition. And I think it is really hard to find the balance, but I'm not comfortable just writing fluff. Yeah. And sometimes I just want to be fluffy. I just want to be like silly, or like just want to make people laugh, or be really abrasive, or just say some shit you would never think would come out of anybody's mouth, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I just, I think there are parts of me that do like shock value, or like, I like get off on it in some way. I don't really know. I haven't explored that all the way yet, but I've recognized it a little bit. And then I think I have to be true to myself, and I'm a very dark person. Like, I'm very silly, and I'm a loving person, and I love everybody, but I am very, I do have a lot of darkness. I am dark in there. And I think without, you know, shedding light on that, to be really cliche, I wouldn't be being honest or true to myself. And that's why my name is Manchita, because it's like my, like, I am stained. I am blemished. I am imperfect. I am one big scab, you know? I am a healing process in my entirety. That's like all I'm doing ever. But the darkness, that's the part I really struggle with. I think like the truly dark matter that I make is the stuff that no one's seen. That's the stuff that's unreleased. There's like projects on projects on projects. That,
really?
Yeah. And they might never see the light of day, just because at this point, you know, they're 4, 3, 2 years old, and it's like, I'm just gonna let those be my journal entries, you know, and I have to let go. But there's more dark matter coming. Don't you worry. I got plenty of darkness. But yeah.
That's interesting. When I was interviewing Adam Levy for this podcast, he talked about being afraid that his most serious material was going to be a burden on people.
Yeah.
And that performing it was going to unload all of these feelings onto people,
right,
and make them feel heavy. And and we were talking about, you know, how do you negotiate that? Because I think when I'm in my darkest moments, like, I crave connection to other people that have felt like that. So I really find solace in like a super depressing song.
Oh, hell yeah. Me too.
And I mean, I have entire playlists, you know, Crying is Fun Sometimes is one of them. And
yeah.
Like, it's 12 below, like,
for sure.
And there's something very validating to know that someone else has been there too, and that they can express it, and that it kind of helps you to express it too. But
yeah,
I understand what you're saying about like the balance. I mean, I think my favorite art is both the darkest and the lightest that you can imagine, and mm-hmm. like bringing them together and contrasting them. And I find that really compelling.
Yeah. The word burden.
Mm-hmm.
I think as people who struggle with mental health issues, that's like the most common feeling mm-hmm. that we have mm-hmm. is like, I'm just going to keep this because I don't want to burden anybody. I'm not going to call anyone right now because then they're going to have to stop what they're doing. And then they're going to worry about me for 2 days and they're going to like text me and call me. And I think it's more about us feeling another sense of shame and guilt.
Yeah.
Because if my friend called me and was like, dude, I'm all the way at the bottom and I can't breathe right now.
Yeah.
I would be like, cool, I'll be right over.
Yeah.
You know? And I wouldn't feel burdened.
Right.
And so when I think about it like that, I'm like, God, that's dumb to feel that way. But when it's me, yeah, I don't call anybody.
Yeah.
I sit with it by myself. But I think that's a really complicated feeling. And I think it's something that we all feel.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
That is probably part of it for me too. And I think another part of musically why I haven't shared a lot of that stuff is... I've never like talked about this in an interview before, or just really ever, like in regards to my music, because I'll explain why, I guess. But, Michael Larson, Idea, and I, we dated for on and off for 5 years. And he was my person. And that grief is so thick and will forever be. It's like my skin now, you know? It's just, it's always going to be there. And one thing that happened when he died was I was ostracized from the community, and I was his family felt like I was responsible somehow. Their logic led them to that conclusion, even though I have never used heroin in my life and I never will. Somehow I was responsible for his overdose. And so with that, they banned me from the funeral.
Mm.
And every memorial, every benefit concert, any mention of me, there's like a documentary that's coming out. There have been articles. There have been just tons of stuff relating to him and his death. And I'm omitted from everything. And people were even threatened that if they contacted me or spent time with me or comforted me or made music with me or ever went to a show of mine, that they would be removed from his label, or their music with him wouldn't be released, or they wouldn't be allowed to perform at this show, or they wouldn't be allowed to participate in this or that. And, you know, it's a lot of people. It's a lot of beautiful, talented, amazing people, and I can't hold it against them. I understand what it is to grieve. I really do, and I understand how confusing it is. And I didn't want to be removed from the community that I needed, and I understand why they had to make the choices they made to not be removed and exiled.
Yeah.
You know, but it meant that I was all alone. And I feel guilty saying that out loud, because I feel like one of the consequences of that whole experience that is still continuing to this day is that I don't feel like I'm allowed to grieve about his passing. And that sort of feeling has made it so that I haven't felt like I'm allowed to release anything that is about that, and right. everything's about that.
Right.
And so it's been a really, like, you know, people ask me, like, why haven't you put anything out? Why haven't you put stuff out? Like, why, what's wrong with you? And it's such a complicated thing to explain. Like, I can't explain to you that I don't feel like I'm allowed to share my story. I don't feel like I'm allowed to grieve. I don't feel like I have a right to my feelings, essentially. And there are parts of me that wonder if it ever happened, you know, like to feel so removed from the situation that, you know, I wondered, did we really, you know? But I know that we did, and I'm lucky that I'm lucky that we had what we had, because there, when I'm not in moments of extreme, like, questioning and fear, I know exactly what we had.
Yeah.
What we have, you know, it's not gone. It's not gone for me, even though he's not here. So, and that's a hard thing to say as well, too, because I do have a partner now, and he's an amazing person. And it's always really, you know, I don't want to make him uncomfortable, and I don't want to in any way, like, undermine what we have, which is very beautiful. But, Michael was my best friend, and my, he was my person, you know, like, he was, when you meet that person that you know, like, suddenly you make sense.
Yeah.
And, I miss him every day. But, that's partly why I had to make the tampon song. It's like, I need to get something out there. I gotta do something. And I can't be serious because I'm gonna choke on it. But yeah, so it's hard. It's hard to find a balance. I think that grief has really controlled a lot of my life, and I think a lot of my art too, which is really hard, and it feels really good to finally, like, say this out loud.
You probably know things about him that nobody else has ever seen or know.
Right. And I think erasing our relationship from his life is erasing, or from his legacy, is erasing some of the most beautiful parts of him, because we did a lot of growing together.
Yeah.
And I think he became a man while we were together, and I think I became a woman, and it just isn't fair to his memory to denounce certain aspects of his growth and his being and his struggle and his beauty and his love that he was able to share, you know? Because, like, what else do you leave behind?
Yeah.
So.
Will you tell me more about him? What was he like? To be with?
Probably one of the funniest people I've ever met. Definitely the smartest person I've ever known in my life. A really good listener. Extremely talented at everything except for, sorry, Michael, drawing. I know you loved it, but oh my God, I'm glad you found the mic. He used to brag, like, no, I used to go to car shows and, like, draw people's cars and, like, sell them the pictures. And I was like, yeah, because you were 8. And people were, like, being nice. But he loved to draw, but he was definitely a musician and a writer and a philosopher. But I think the thing about Michael was that he was everybody's best friend. Like, anybody who was really friends with him, he was the best friend that they could possibly have. Yeah. You know? And he understood the world almost like he'd been here, like, 100 times already, and had this other kind of grip where you could, as long as you were, like, with him, you could see type of a thing. He was amazing. He made me laugh a lot. And I think the thing that brought us together was we were constantly battling, like, wits. It was like a battle of the wits, like who knows more, we just were constantly flexing on each other and making each other the butt of the joke. And but also very, he was really good at opening you, your mind, in a really gentle way. He was really good at basically giving you the glasses and allowing you to see without condescension, just really a clear connection to, like, this other understanding of the world. And he was a teacher. I don't think I've learned more from any one person, any single person, than I learned from Michael. And he was patient. He was great. He was the best. My favorite person. My favorite. And he was open-minded too. He had a lot to learn. When we first met, he was 22. And he, you know, he was saying bitch. He had lines about, like, girls, like that was, like, a thing that he would like battle and, like, talk about fucking somebody's sister, like their mom, or like. And I had to, like, call him out on it and be like, hey, like, this makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It makes me feel weird when you talk negatively about women for being women, or talk negatively about a man and call him a woman or a bitch.
Hmm.
I hate the word bitch. I don't use that word. I prefer to say B word. But if you're going to, like, use it to make a point, I think you might as well just say it.
Yeah.
But he eventually understood what I was talking about, and he changed the way that he spoke and the way that he looked at things and the way that he looked at women. I remember, like, Michael was like, but girls can't rap. And I was like, we should talk about that. You know, mm-hmm. Like, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why? And interrogating it, we got to a place where he eventually was like, well, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Oops. Like, he was open-minded enough, though, to be able to actually change his perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, also homophobia was a thing that we discussed. I came with my tool set. He came with his. We changed each other in positive ways, I think. But yeah, we grew a lot together. And that was one. He was definitely the reason I was like, I will never be a rapper.
Mm.
Because I didn't want to live in his shadow.
Right.
I didn't want to be a cliche. Like, I didn't want him to ever feel like he had to help me. I didn't want anybody to you know, think that I was ever just dating him so that I could get a leg up or whatever. I was genuinely uninterested in rapping because it was, like, the biggest turnoff that could possibly be.
Yeah.
Until it was finally like, why aren't you doing this? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know why I'm not, except that I'm afraid and that I have some sort of weird resentment about it, you know? And I started rapping. So it was August 6th was the day that Olsen called me. And that was the day I started rapping. And I was lucky enough to be able to share that music with Michael before he died. And he instantly was like, oh yeah, for sure. This is what I've been telling you for years. You know, like, why? And he used to drive me nuts. But every time I had a final or I was freaking out about my homework, he was like, you should drop out.
Mm.
You're supposed to be making music. You need to drop out of college. Wow. And I was so offended every time. I was like, you don't think I can handle it? You know, you da, 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 da. And I would get so pissed. But then it was like, it's like one of those moments where your mom or your dad's like, I told you so. And after I made the songs, I was like, okay, you were right, you know? And he's like, this is going to be great. Like, fully support this. This is it. This is what you're supposed to be doing. And I don't, if I didn't have that, I don't know if I'd be doing what I'm doing.
Mm.
Because after he died, it was the only thing that I knew I needed to do.
Yeah.
Because it was the only thing that I knew. Yeah. That I needed to do.
Yeah.
And so it was like a weird, not like a passing of the torch, but like a kind of, in a way, of just like a blessing. I bless you, my child. Like, go on, do your thing.
Yeah.
And that's partly I don't speak about it, you know, because I don't feel like I'm allowed to. And partly I don't speak about it because I don't want to be ever told that I'm riding someone's coattails. Like, I don't freestyle in public because there's just parts of me that I want distance from his musical legacy.
Yeah.
I want that distance because I need to be able to stand on my own because I'm already so close and tied up in him otherwise.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah. So
thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah, thanks for being you, because if it wasn't, I don't know if I could have. We were young. As he says, too young, drunk, compulsive, loaded guns, and love. That's exactly what we were.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember, because he would, you know, he was my partner, and I was going through a lot of shit. You know, I was depressed and I was dealing with my anxiety and my OCD and all this stuff. He got sucked in there. It's hard to be partners with someone who is so far underwater and not start drowning yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that experience of mine really deeply impacted him and affected him. And that is something that has definitely informed my feelings about feeling like a burden. You know?
Yeah.
So now I do feel a little bit more like guarded about reaching out, because I don't want to pull anyone in, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think he was done.
Yeah.
And I think I don't think things happen for a reason. I think we make reasons out of them. But the reason that happened is because we're mortal and science, you know?
Right.
Simple as that. But yeah, it's crazy. It's been 5 years now. It doesn't feel like 5 years.
Does it feel like longer or less time?
Less time.
Yeah.
It's so fresh, you know? Like, it's right there all the time. Right there.
Mm-hmm.
Captain, be brave. Courage, here I am. The vessel sinks so soon. And if you're going down, me too. Smooth sails won't stay. Peril can't be planned. Are you gonna jump me first so I can catch you when you land? Wind blew you down, or maybe you just let go. I don't want to blame you, 'cause that would make me useless too.
Thank you so much to Claire for such a moving, enlightening, evocative conversation. I can't think of a better way to wrap up the first season of this podcast than with such an honest portrayal of the struggle an artist faces when they're in the public eye, and I commend her for her bravery in sharing her story in her own words. This has been the season one finale of The OK Show. It's a podcast that features real musicians talking about their real lives. Thank you so much to The Current for giving me the platform to host these conversations. This experience has been way more rewarding than I could have ever imagined, and I can't wait to return with an even bigger and better season two. So come back on December 9th for my season two kickoff episode with a very special guest, Lizzo.
Let's get it.
We'll unpack her new album, her powerful messages of empowerment and self-love, and we'll talk about her own journey toward learning to truly love herself. Don't forget, you can find all of the OK Show podcasts over at thecurrent.org, and thank you so much to all of my season one guests, Charlie Van Stee, Mary Beth Mueller, Adam Levy, Irv Williams, Lydia Liza, Astronautilus, Maida, and of course, Manchita. I'm your host, Andrea Swenson, and until next time, it's gonna be OK. Let the person in charge say so. Now who's in charge of you?